which Trump seemingly would love to do. So I know about the Hitler speeches on Trump's nightstand, according to one of Trump's ex-wives. I know about the love letters with Kim Jong-un, but I don't think he's as impressed with Kim Jong-un. He's impressed with Kim Jong-un as look at what this young guy has done. But he genuinely seems just smitten with Putin and Chinese President Xi. If you disagree with me, let me know. And lastly, here's a viewer who is reacting to my horror about Trump by saying, and Biden doesn't horrify you? Please, God forbid he gets us in another conflict and bows down to those bullies pushing us around. We need strong leadership. The world's watching and Biden's like the girl next door, sweet but no backbone. Again, I don't know what conflicts Biden, quote, got us into, and I don't know which leaders Biden is, quote, bowing down to. In fact, even with the allegation that he's bowing down to Netanyahu, the last week of news certainly doesn't suggest that that's the case. Getting on the phone and saying you've got to do a ceasefire, you've got to let Gaza aid through, pushing for more Gaza aid. And now the IDF says the invasion has been suspended. I don't see Biden being pushed around by anybody. And if he were, I would certainly tell you. So another confused Trump supporter. But remember, you can be confused and vote. You can have a completely backwards sort of moral framework and vote. And so the only way we make sure that these folks don't end up putting their guy in power is we have to make sure that we vote. We have a fantastic bonus show for you today. You can sign up at joinpacman.com and get instant access. And remember that all of the children's books, including the newest one, Think Like a Voter, makes a great election year gift for the child in your life or in someone else's life. The books are all available at davidpacman.com/book. We will see you on the bonus show and be back. Say what you want about the validity and importance of polls in April of an election year. The tone and the feel and the dynamics of this presidential race are changing. And we start with new polling in which things are looking pretty damn good for President Joe Biden. Nothing is a guarantee. More than likely, this is an election that will come down to about 500,000 votes in five states. But if you have an option between it'll be close and the polls look bad for Biden, or it'll be close and the polls look pretty good for Biden, if your goal is to prevent the potential downfall of democracy with 4 years of dangerous authoritarianism, you choose, if you're a logical person, as I try to be, you choose the scenario in which the polls look better. And indeed, Joe Biden is now beating Donald Trump in a majority of polls. I'll be honest, it's a very slim majority, right? It's like 50% plus one polls. But also, the betting markets have shifted for the first time towards Joe Biden in months. And individually, none of it means anything. There are people who will write to me and say, David, those stupid prediction markets mean nothing. It's kids in their mom's basements playing on websites. All right, well, we can ignore the betting markets. Oh, and David, the polling also means nothing. Well, there is a momentum shift in the polling from a small lead by Trump to a small lead by Biden. By itself, maybe it doesn't tell us everything we need to know, but it all still together is a picture that rejects the notion that Biden can't win. That's the important takeaway. So many have fallen into this doom and gloom. Biden simply cannot win. And there is no evidence whatsoever that Biden cannot win. He might not win. Right. That's true. But he certainly can win. So Newsweek reports Joe Biden is now beating Donald Trump in the majority of recent polls 7 months before the election. Analysis has turned to who will come out on top. Polls have been evenly split, with commentators suggesting the race is too close to call. And it is too close to call. I mean, any election that will come down to 500,000 votes in five states and possibly a 1 or 1.5 point margin separating the candidates in those critical states, it is too close to call. But we have data we can look at. And as the article points out, polls appear to be moving in Joe Biden's favor. And that is something we like to see. So we look at a bunch of different polls here. One of the things is we really should divide the polls into the higher quality versus the lower quality polls. Some of those higher quality polls include The Economist, which has it as Trump plus one, but they previously had Trump further ahead. The Ipsos Reuters poll has Biden ahead among adults by one and among registered voters by four. The Morning Consult poll has Trump plus one, but it previously had Trump leading by more. The tip.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
In the face of the Iranian threat, we will build a regional coalition and exact the price from Iran in the fashion and timing that is right for us. And most importantly, faced with the desire of our enemies to harm us, we will continue to unite and become stronger.
The Middle East braces for Israel to retaliate amidst calls for restraint after Iran fired over 300 drones and missiles at Israel in response to Israel's attack on the Iranian consulate in Syria. We'll go to Tehran, Tel Aviv, and Washington, D.C. Then Donald Trump makes history today in a New York courtroom as the first former president to stand trial for criminal charges.
On Monday in New York City, I will be forced to sit fully gagged. I'm not allowed to talk. Can you believe it? They want to take away my constitutional right to talk. I have a crooked judge.
Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg may be the only prosecutor in four pending criminal cases to try Trump on criminal charges before Election Day. Jury selection begins today. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres is calling for maximum restraint after Iran launched 300 drones and missiles at Israel in retaliation for Israel's recent bombing of the Iranian consulate in Damascus. The Iranian attack caused little damage after Israel intercepted nearly all of the drones and missiles with help from the United States, Britain, France, and Jordan. One 7-year-old Bedouin girl in Israel was seriously injured in the attack after she was hit by shrapnel. While Iran and Israel have been engaged in a shadow war for years, this marked the first time Iran has directly targeted Israel from Iranian soil. The UN Secretary General spoke Sunday at an emergency UN Security Council meeting.
The Middle East is on the brink. The people of the region are confronting a real danger of a devastating full-scale conflict. Now is the time to defuse and de-escalate. Now is the time for maximum restraint.
Israeli War Cabinet member Benny Gantz has vowed Israel will retaliate against Iran.
In the face of the Iranian threat, we will build a regional coalition and exact the price from Iran in the fashion and timing that is right for us.
President Biden has reiterated his ironclad support for Israel, but he reportedly told Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that the United States will not participate in any retaliatory strikes against Iran. At the United Nations Sunday, Iran's UN ambassador, Saeed Erivani, defended the missile and drone attack on Israel, saying it was done in self-defense.
These countries, especially the United States, have shielded Israel from any responsibility for the Gaza massacre, while they have denied Iran inherent right to self-defense against the Israeli armed attack on our diplomatic premises. At the same time, they shamefully justified the Israeli massacre and genocide against the defenseless Palestinian people under the pretext of self-defense.
We'll go to Tehran, Washington, D.C., and Tel Aviv after headlines. Israel's continuing its assault on Gaza, where the official death toll has reached 33,800. On Sunday, Israeli forces opened fire on displaced Palestinians who are attempting to return to their homes in northern Gaza. Israel also bombed the Nusayrat refugee camp in central Gaza, killing at least five people and injuring dozens. In the occupied West Bank, armed settlers attacked the Palestinian village of Al-Mutahir, at least 10 other villages over the weekend, in what's been described as the largest settler rampage against Palestinians in the West Bank since October 7th. The violence in the West Bank began after the disappearance of an Israeli teenager who was later found dead after being killed in what Israel called a terrorist attack. Palestinian authorities say the settlers burned down dozens of homes and structures. One Palestinian was killed, dozens injured, when residents of Al-Mutahir condemned the settler violence.
My son was injured. My nephew was injured. Most of the people here were injured. They burnt the cars. They tried to open the houses to burn them. They could not, so they damaged everything they could. The water tanks, not leaving anything unharmed. It lasted between 2 to 3 hours. Then they started moving to the other houses, heading west. They burnt houses, vehicles, and they took sheep. They went on until the end of the village, not leaving one house unharmed, with no reason, claiming that there's a settler that has gone missing.
Here in New York City, the first ever criminal trial of a U.S. president starts today as jury selection gets underway in Donald Trump's hush money case. The former president is charged with 34 felony counts of falsifying business records to hide a $130,000 payment to adult film star Stormy Daniels to influence the 2016 election. On Friday, Trump told reporters he intends to testify during the trial. We'll have more on the trial later in the show. We'll be speaking with defense attorney Ron Kuby. Today marks 1 year since the devastating war in Sudan erupted. An estimated 15,000 people have been killed, another 8.6 million forcibly displaced in what the UN calls one of the worst displacement and humanitarian crises in the world and one of the most ignored, unquote. The Sudanese Army and the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, have both been accused of war crimes as the conflict shows no signs of abating. Widespread sexual violence, indiscriminate attacks, targeting of health facilities and the restriction of aid has left communities across Sudan shattered with dwindling resources to support them. Safa Abdul-Muttalib is now in South Sudan after her family was forced to flee Khartoum.
It was very, very difficult. For a long period, we were hiding under our beds, no food, no water, no help. The bombs came from all sides, especially where we lived. It was extremely difficult as we were surrounded by army bases and military industrial complexes.
The RSF has also been accused of ethnic cleansing and the targeting of non-Arab groups, including the ethnic Masalit community. The UN is calling on countries to step up funding for Sudan, where some 25 million people are in dire need of assistance. France is hosting a conference in Paris today with the goal of securing aid pledges from European countries. In Australia, police say the man who went on a deadly stabbing rampage at a Sydney shopping center Saturday was likely targeting women. Five of the six fatal victims were women. The one man killed by the assailant was a security guard who attempted to stop the attack. The stabber was eventually shot and killed by police. Some 20 people overall were stabbed, including a nine-month-old baby girl. The baby survived, but her mother did not. The mass killing at the Westfield Bondi Junction has rattled Australia, where mass casualty events are rare. On Capitol Hill, the House voted Friday to reauthorize Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance, or FISA Act, which has been used by federal agencies to conduct warrantless surveillance of Americans. The House vote came just days after a group of Republicans temporarily blocked a move to extend the law after Donald Trump urged lawmakers to kill the bill. Democratic Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon denounced the House bill, saying it, quote, represents one of the most dramatic and terrifying expansions of government surveillance authority in history, Wyden said. Vice President Kamala Harris told voters in Tucson, Arizona, Donald Trump is responsible for Arizona's recent revival of an 1864 abortion ban.
Y'all must understand who is to blame. Former President Donald Trump did this. During his campaign in 2016, Donald Trump said women should be punished for seeking an abortion. Don't forget that. He said women should be punished.
Vice President Harris made the remarks in her second visit this year to the key battleground state of Arizona. And related news, organizers in Colorado say they've collected enough signatures to add a measure to the November ballot calling for enshrining abortion access in Colorado's constitution. Arizona activists also plan to add an amendment on abortion rights to their state's ballot. Police in Germany raided and shut down a pro-Palestinian conference in Berlin Friday. The Palestine Congress was scheduled to be held for 3 days, but the event was shut down as the first panelist spoke. In addition, Germany's Interior Ministry banned some conference speakers from even entering Germany or addressing it remotely, including former Greek finance minister Yanis Varoufakis and the Palestinian-British surgeon Hassan Abousseta, who worked in Gaza. Dr. Abousseta spoke to Middle East Eye after he was barred entry.
Upon arrival, I was stopped at the passport office. I was then escorted down to the basement of the airport, where I was questioned for around 3.5 hours. At the end of 3.5 hours, I was told that I will not be allowed to enter German soil.
To see Democracy Now!'s interview with the doctor after he came out of Gaza, go to democracynow.org. German authorities defended the decision to shut down the conference, citing German laws against so-called hate speech. And here in the United States, the political theorist Jody Dean has been relieved of teaching duties while officials at Hobart and William Smith Colleges investigate her writings on Gaza. Dean recently wrote a blog post on the Verso website in defense of Palestinian resistance. On Saturday, she wrote a message on social media saying, quote, McCarthyism is real. I've been relieved of teaching responsibilities. Don't stop talking about Palestine, she said. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Middle East is bracing for possible retaliation from Israel after Iran launched 300 drones and missiles at Israel in response to Israel's recent bombing of the Iranian consulate in Damascus, Syria. The Iranian attack caused little damage inside Israel, which intercepted nearly all the drones and missiles with help from the United States, Britain, France, and Jordan. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called for maximum restraint Sunday at an emergency UN Security Council meeting.
The Middle East is on the brink. The people of the region are confronting a real danger of a devastating full-scale conflict. Now is the time to defuse and de-escalate. Now is the time for maximum restraint.
As we broadcast, Israel's war cabinet is reconvening to debate how to respond to Iran's first-ever direct attack. Israeli war cabinet member Benny Gantz has vowed Israel will retaliate against Iran.
In the face of the Iranian threat, we will build a regional coalition and exact the price from Iran in the fashion and timing that is right for us. And most importantly, faced with the desire of our enemies to harm us, we will continue to unite and become stronger.
President Biden's reiterated his, quote, ironclad support for Israel, but he reportedly told Israel's Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, that the United States will not participate in any retaliatory strikes against Iran. At the United Nations Sunday, Iran's UN ambassador, Saeed Erivani, defended the missile and drone attack on Israel, saying it was done in self-defense.
These countries, especially the United States, have shielded Israel from any responsibility for the Gaza massacre, while they have denied Iran inherent right to self-defense against the Israeli armed attack on our diplomatic premises. At the same time, they shamefully justified the Israeli massacre and genocide against the defenseless Palestinian people under the pretext of self-defense.
Iran's attacks on Israel may add new momentum for the U.S. Congress to approve more aid for Israel as the House returns to session today. For more, we go to Tehran, where we're joined by Reza Shea, freelance journalist based in Tehran, where he joins us from. Trita Parsi is executive vice president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, joining us from Washington, D.C. And later we'll speak with Gideon Levy, award-winning Israeli journalist and author in Tel Aviv. He's columnist for the newspaper Haaretz, a member of its editorial board. His most recent piece is headlined, "If Iran Attacks Israel, the Blame Lies on Israel's Irresponsible Decision-Makers." We welcome you all to Democracy Now! Reza Shea, let's begin with you in Tehran. Can you talk about the response there in Iran's capital after Iran retaliated against Israel for bombing the Iranian consulate in Damascus?
Well, the people of Iran have had a variety of responses and sentiments, and I think it's important to remind everyone that neither myself nor any journalist can sit here and tell you that a population, an entire population, has a single feeling, a single voice, a single sentiment. But this is what you hear oftentimes in Western news media, journalists describing what an entire population is feeling or saying. That's simply not the case. There are different competing sentiments in every population, and that is the case here in Iran. There's a segment of the population here in Iran that are staunch supporters of the clerical establishment, staunch supporters of the supreme leader. They believe that it's the duty of every Muslim to support and help the oppressed, and they view Gazans and Palestinians as the oppressed. They're following very closely the events in Gaza over the past 6 months. They were outraged when Iran's consulate was attacked in Syria. And they cheered Iran's response over the weekend when they fired those rockets and those drones in Israel. That's one segment of the population. There's another segment of the population in Iran that are staunch critics of the government. They have a very different view. They want reform in the government. Some want the government gone. They don't mind when senior officials of the Revolutionary Guard are assassinated. They don't mind when the establishment is undermined, when the Revolutionary Guard is undermined. They believe that the Iranian government, instead of funding Hezbollah and Hamas, should help the people. So they are and they remain critical of Iran's role in this conflict. But it's important to point out that most people here in Iran are remarkably continuing their lives. Obviously, some people are worried. They see the headlines. They wonder what's going to happen. But remarkably, they continue their lives. Schools are open. Stores are open. Businesses are open. And I think that speaks to the resilience of the Iranian people, who face so many challenges over these last 40 plus years, isolation, a horrible economy, inflation, the lack of jobs, but somehow they continue living while monitoring what's happening.
Can you talk about who died in the attack on the Iranian consulate in Damascus? At least two Iranian generals, is that right?
Yeah, these were two Iranian generals that had significant roles in Iran's presence in Syria and the reported operations that Iran has conducted against U.S. targets in the region, in Syria and Iraq. And it's important to note that that many people within the government continue to remind everyone that this was an act of war by Israel, even though Israel has not confirmed that it conducted the attack in the Iranian consulate. Iran continues to remind the international community. They did it at the UN Security Council meeting, that Iran's attack on Israel was a response to an act of war that Israel carried out against an Iranian consulate, which is seen as Iranian soil. It is also important to point out that Iran's response took 2 weeks, and that is in line with how Iran has reacted to similar incidents and assassinations in recent years. You recall the assassination of General Soleimani, the top-ranking Revolutionary Guard general in Iraq in 2020. You'll recall Iran's response was to attack a U.S. airbase in Iraq, but just as they did with this attack in Israel, they took a lot of time. It is reported that they even announced what they were going to do, and that's a clear indication that Iran does not want to escalate matters with Israel and the U.S. And regional allies, that this was, as many say, a performative operation to send a message and calculated in a way where the, Iran doesn't want to escalate matters. And you saw Iranian officials explicitly say that for them, the matter is over. Now we wait to see if Israel agrees, if it's over for them, if they retaliate, and what Iran does after that.
I want to go to John Bolton, Trump's former national security advisor, interviewed on CNN.
Give us your assessment of an appropriate Israeli response to what Iran has now done.
Well, what Iran did tonight that I think was most significant was the firing of ballistic missiles and cruise missiles from its territory directly at Israel. Almost certainly at this point, none of those missiles contained a nuclear warhead. But you never can tell when the next firing, the next salvo of ballistic missiles might contain a nuclear warhead. So I think among the many targets Israel should consider, this is the opportunity to destroy Iran's nuclear weapons program. And I hope President Biden is not trying to dissuade Prime Minister Netanyahu from doing that.
So that was John Bolton speaking on CNN. We're also joined by Trita Parsi, Executive Vice President of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, speaking to us from Washington, D.C. Trita, can you respond to what Bolton said and also how Washington is responding right now?
Well, I think you saw there in John Bolton's response, he used the word opportunity. And this is how some of the hawks view this. They see this as an opportunity to materialize the war between the United States and Iran and Israel that they have been seeking for more than 25 years. And that includes Bibi Netanyahu. I think it should not be forgotten that Netanyahu has been trying to start a war between the United States and Iran for more than two decades. And it has seen him being actually rebuffed by several presidents in a row who may have been very hawkish in Iran, who may themselves have contemplated the idea of going to war with Iran, but who nevertheless rejected the pressure from Netanyahu to do so on behalf of Israel. But Bolton is reflecting that view, the idea that this is an opportunity to have a much larger war in the Middle East.
And can you talk about President Biden saying that Israel has the ironclad support of the U.S., but telling Netanyahu after this attack that the U.S. would not participate in any kind of retaliation, though the U.S. intercepted, I think they said, how many drones and something like six missiles and 90 drone strikes on with the Iranian attack. Jordan also participated, as did Britain and France.
I think what Biden is saying here is quite contradictory, because at the end of the day, there will be no distinction between offensive and defensive measures the second the war actually breaks out. So consider this scenario. The United States does not support and does not participate in Israel's counterstrikes against Iran, and the Israelis may follow Bolton's advice and try to target Iran's nuclear facilities. The Iranians then respond in kind with a much larger barrage of missiles. Clearly, what they did this time around was choreographed to minimize damage and make sure that there's no casualties. Next time around, they won't do that. Once the Iranians have started their counterstrikes, then the United States is dragged into the war because Biden said that he will participate in the defensive measures. And then, regardless of what the previous measure was by the United States, the U.S. will be at war in the Middle East. And as a result, Netanyahu now has a clear pathway on how to drag the United States into this war. All he needs to do is to escalate further. The U.S. will reject that, but then the U.S. will be there once the Iranians are responding. And at that point, any distinction between offensive and defensive is meaningless. If Biden instead makes it very, very clear that it does not lie in the U.S.'s interest to have any escalation in the region and draws a red line in front of Iran and in front of Israel, he will then not need to come to the defense of Israel because there will not be a war to begin with. That would be a much better pathway that serves U.S. interests, that prevents any regional escalation. But so far we have seen that Biden, even though he apparently is frustrated privately, he does not feel comfortable to draw any red lines for Israel publicly. And the ones that he has drawn privately, Netanyahu has systematically ignored for the last 7 months.
We're talking to Trita Parsi, who's executive vice president of the Quincy Institute, has written several books on Iran and the United States. We're going to continue with him and Reza Sayah, freelance journalist in Tehran, and we'll be joined by Gideon Levy, who is Haaretz columnist on the editorial board of Haaretz, wrote the article, "If Iran Attacks Israel, the Blame Lies on Israel's Irresponsible Decision Makers." Back in 30 seconds. دوره دوره پشت کوها یه صبوره پشت دشتا یه تلایی پشت صحرا های خالی خونه ماست اون بره آب اون بره موجا Unayema, Our House by Marjan Farsad. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Middle East is bracing for Israel to retaliate amidst claims, calls for restraint after Iran fired over 350 drones and missiles at Israel in response to Israel's attack on the Iranian consulate in Syria that killed two Iranian generals and another a number of other military officers. We are joined by guests in Tehran and Washington, D.C., and now to Tel Aviv, where we're joined by Gideon Levy, an award-winning Israeli journalist and author, columnist for the newspaper Haaretz, and a member of its editorial board. His most recent piece, headlined, "If Iran Attacks Israel, the Blame Lies on Israel's Irresponsible Decision-Makers." In it, Gideon writes, quote, "For several years now, Israel's provoked Iran constantly in Lebanon, Syria, and also on Iranian soil, and has not paid any price. It would be foolish to believe that the rope Israel has stretched will not break. That moment may have come." He ends by writing, "Just don't say again that there was no choice. There was a choice not to kill. Even if it's deserved, even if it's permitted, and even if it's possible, the person who sent the assassins put Israel at risk of war with Iran." Gideon Levy, you are joined. You are joining Reza Sayah, a freelance journalist in Tehran, Iran, and Trita Parsi, one of the heads of the Quincy Institute. Can you respond to Iran's attack and what Israel did to provoke that—the bombing of the Iranian consulate in Damascus? Did that surprise you?
Nothing surprised here. The only thing which surprised, really, was the defensive capability of Israel. Together with its allies, it was really impressive, but it's not a guarantee for the future. When I wrote my article, it was before the attack came, and still I thought that the assassination in Damascus was unnecessary. The problem with the Israeli armed forces and intelligence organizations is that whenever they see an opportunity, they take it without thinking about the consequences, without thinking about the price. And until now, it was working for them because Iran didn't react until now directly on Israel, only through its proxy. But it was very clear that this cannot last forever. So those who send the assassinators to assassinate on Iranian soil, on an Iranian diplomatic mission, those two generals and five more, those had to think what will be the next day. And the next day came, and we were attacked. And luckily enough, we didn't suffer out of this attack. The only conclusion right now should be, no, don't you dare to retaliate now, because then we will be in a regional war, and that's a new game.
Talk about what Benny Gantz said. As we broadcast right now, the war cabinet, Israel's war cabinet, has reconvened. What Netanyahu said, of course, they are competing with each other. If Netanyahu were to go down, it's conceivable Gideon Levy would become the next prime minister. But talk about what's happening within that war cabinet. Benny Gantz.
Amy, it's for a long time that I claim that those who want to get rid of Netanyahu are obviously right, but they hope that the alternative will be any better on core issues. On many issues, it will be much better. But on core issues like apartheid, occupation, continuing the war in Gaza, will be very, very disappointed. And here we go. Benny Gantz, who is the alternative? Who is the liberal alternative? Who is the dovish alternative of Israel? He speaks exactly like Netanyahu and would act exactly like Netanyahu when it comes to core issues, to core questions like launching an assassination, like launching a war, like using the military power of Israel. And that's really very, very depressing, that there is no alternative thinking in Israel and no lessons out of the experience. All the assassinations that Israel committed, all of them, never led to anywhere. Nothing good came out of them, except of the ego of the organizations who stood behind it. And here comes this Benny Gantz, the big hope of the liberal Israel, and suggests to continue the war, to make it worse, to go for a regional war with Iran. That's really, really very depressing.
Are you concerned, Gideon Levy, that what's happening with Iran now is taking attention away from what's happening in Gaza, where the death toll just continues to mount, over close to 34,000 people? Just the official death toll is expected to be much higher. And where resistance was mounting in the United States, for example, on President Biden not to arm Israel, given what's happening in Gaza, now the House, which is notoriously divided, is perhaps coming together around giving more aid to Israel.
It goes without saying, not only Gaza is forgotten. Also, look what is happening in the West. Pogrom after pogrom, and nobody cares anymore. The army collaborates in those pogroms. We have videos from the last days in which the army not only stands aside, but many times take part of those pogroms against the Palestinians, and nobody pays attention to it. Not to speak, obviously, about Gaza, because everyone is now concerned about Iran. But Gaza is still starving and bleeding, and we shouldn't forget it, even not for a moment, like we shouldn't forget the hostages who are still there. But it seems that now everyone is only concerned about retaliating Iran. This would be such a major, maybe fatal mistake.
I wanted to bring back in Reza Sayah. You were based in Cairo, Egypt, when you covered the negotiations between Israel and Hamas in 2014, as Israel launched its assault on Gaza then. Can you talk about what unfolded back then and how it compares to the negotiations that are taking place, what, in Doha and Cairo now for a ceasefire?
Well, obviously, back then, what took place, as is taking place right now on a smaller scale, was the killing of lots of innocent civilians. But one thing that sticks out in my mind in 2014 in covering that conflict was the Israeli government's flat-out refusal to negotiate. There were so many instances when I was talking to Hamas leaders who were in Cairo. And in these instances, they would tell me that the Israeli officials who were supposed to show up, you know, for those negotiations simply would not show up. And this was something that was not widely reported by Western U.S. Media. The Israeli government's seeming unwillingness to negotiate with Hamas. Eventually, there was negotiations, and that war ended. But in subsequent years leading up to this conflict, the cycle of war continued. But that's something that sticks out in my mind in that 2014 conflict.
I wanted to ask about Jordan's position in all of this, Trita Parsi, what role it plays. You had the United States, Britain, Jordan, France, all intercepting some of these drones and missiles.
Yes, numerous countries participated in the interception of these missiles, and the only reason they could do so was because the Iranians had given them 72 hours heads up deliberately, because the entire purpose of this exercise was not to inflict damage, but to restore what the Iranians believe is their deterrence and showcase their capability. And as Gideon said, the shooting down of these missiles were quite impressive, but I think we also have to keep in mind that there might be a different scenario in the future in which there is no forewarning of these attacks. And as a result, France, Britain, and the United States will not be able to prepare for and participate in this extent in the shooting down of the missile. And then, as a result, it's not entirely clear to what extent the Israeli air defenses would be capable of handling what would likely be a much larger barrage of missiles shot at Israel. So I think the Israelis may have also picked up that at the end of the day, a military confrontation, even though Israel, of course, is much stronger in Iran and certainly the U.S. is, but nevertheless will be very, very damaging to Israel as well. And that, I think, is one of the key messages the Iranians were trying to send. The Jordanians are, of course, caught in the middle there, because all of these different things are then flying over Jordanian airspace. And the Jordanian position has been that they're defending their airspace. They're not defending Israel. This is not done in order to necessarily help the Israelis. It's to make sure that Jordan asserts that no war should be taking place on its territory or in its airspace. That, nevertheless, is a tough position for the Jordanians to take, given the very, very strong sentiments that are now boiling over inside of Jordan because of the population's frustration with what is happening in Gaza and their perception that the Jordanian government and the Arab world at large have been helpless and not done enough to prevent this slaughter.
I wanted to ask Gideon Levy if you've been surprised by the amount of conversation going on between Iran and the United States, perhaps not directly. And also, I want to put that question to Reza Sayah, but where the result is you have United States saying they will not participate in Israel's retaliation if they retaliate against Iran.
First of all, I would say we always portray Iran as a crazy state, as an insane state, and it might be described like this. But in this case, it was very measured, very measured. I wish the United States and Iran would have spoken much more. I wish the agreement, the nuclear agreement, would be still valid, and we would be in a much better place and safer place rather than what both Donald Trump and Netanyahu arranged us, canceling this agreement, which was the best way to prevent Iran from getting nuclear weapons. The more they speak, the better. Under the table, above the table, behind the curtains, any way to talk to them. I still believe that every regime has its own interest, and dialogue is, by the end of the day, the best way, even if it's the Satan of Iran.
And can you talk, as you talked about what's happening also on the West Bank, if you can talk about the most recent news about the death of one of the most prominent Palestinian prisoners in an Israeli prison, died of cancer, novelist Waleed Daqa, who spent the past 38 years locked up for his involvement in an armed group that abducted and killed an Israeli soldier in 1984. Rights groups pressuring Israel to release him, saying he was in dire need of medical attention. Amnesty International calling for his release, saying that since October 7th, he'd been tortured, humiliated, and denied family visits. You've written about this.
I'm following this story for many, many years. I even visited Waleed once in jail many years ago. It's one of those horrible stories which tells you much more than the story itself. Waleed Daqa is an Israeli. He is not a Palestinian from the West Bank. He's an Israeli Palestinian. He, by the way, didn't murder. He participated in a group which kidnapped an Israeli soldier and then killed him. Some of them, he was not involved in it, but he was charged for murder and everything fine. He sat 37 years for this murder, much more than any murderer in the world. In Israel, not in the world. He, in this period, changes, declared that he had enough with terror, declared that he regrets any terror actions. He's exactly the style of leadership that we should look forward to. Those Palestinians who change their minds and leave terror as a tool. But no, for Israel, no Palestinian is good enough. And here in the last years start really a sadistic behavior toward him and his family. No visits. When he started to be ill in cancer, when he got ill, no visits, half a year now. They didn't even inform the family that he's dying. They didn't even inform the family he died. And now it's already 10 days, they don't even return the body and don't let them mourn in their home. I mean, what is more sadistic than this? And what is more the face of this current government of Israel when it comes to Palestinians, Israeli Palestinians, or Palestinians from the West Bank or Gaza? Sadism is the name of the game.
And I wanted to give Reza Sayah the last word. In U.S. media, we don't often hear from people in Tehran. You're a freelance journalist there in the capital of Iran. You've been covering Iran's relationship with Hamas, particularly in the aftermath of October 7th. Could you expand on this and what you think it's most important for people to understand outside of Iran and particularly here in the United States?
Well, I think from the people's standpoint, the people here are resilient. Most of them are peace-loving people who do not want war. And I want to follow up on Mr. Levy's thought about how Iran is often portrayed in Western media to the American and Western audience as a radical, reckless, violent government. And I think a lot of thoughtful analysts will tell you that a radical entity, a radical government, would not last for 45 years like the Islamic Republic that has. And these analysts will tell you that the reason that they have survived for these 45 plus years is that they're not reckless, that they're very calculating and they're measured. And they understand at this very high stakes juncture that there are forces that perhaps Israel wants to bait them into a wider war. And I think Iran understands that that would be a mistake. I think many here understand that if they get baited into a wider war, it would be a distraction to what's happening in Gaza that has served the establishment here well by getting them a lot of political clout. And it would also potentially galvanize and unite Israel with its Western allies that have been critical of Israel and their operation in Gaza. So at this hour, they're waiting to see what Israel does, if Israel retaliates. But history has shown that if Israel retaliates, Iran is going to be aware of what their response is could cost, and they're going to take a measured response. It's obviously a very high-stakes chess game, and a lot of people anxious to see what happens.
And
in the
we just
days.
Have 30 seconds, but Iran's supreme leader, Ali Khamenei, perhaps the longest ruling leader in the world, about to step down, the significance of that?
Well, I'm not aware of these reports that he's about to step down. But obviously, if he steps down, it's going to be a significant impact to the leadership. They've been discussing how they're going to replace him. But I have to tell you, I'm not aware of
And
of,
I might
of those
have overstated
that...
it.
Okay.
Well,
yeah, I'm not sure about those reports. That would be a huge development, but I'm not aware of those reports.
Reza Sayah, I want to thank you so much for being with us, freelance journalist in Tehran, Iran. Gideon Levy, Haaretz columnist, member of its editorial board, and we'll link to your articles. And Trita Parsi, executive vice president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. When we come back, jury selection begins today as Donald Trump makes history as the first former president to stand trial for criminal charges. Back in 20 seconds.
It's been a long, old, slow camp to get.
Avalanche, Avalanche by Maya Lena. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Republican presidential frontrunner Donald Trump's making history today in a New York courtroom as the first former president to stand trial for criminal charges. Jury selection begins today as Trump faces 34 criminal charges, falsifying business records as part of a scheme to hide hush money payments to adult film star Stormy Daniels in an attempt to influence the 2016 election. The payments were not illegal themselves, but Trump's accused of violating federal campaign finance laws because he failed to disclose the payments and recorded them as a legal expense, giving the money to his lawyer. Each of the 34 counts carries a maximum sentence of 4 years in prison. Trump's required to be in the courtroom while prosecutors lay out their case, unlike the civil trials where he chose to be there. He didn't have to be there. Trump's also facing criminal charges in three other cases, two federal cases involving the retention of classified materials and his efforts to overturn the 2020 election that culminated in the January 6th insurrection, and RICO charges in Georgia based on his push to reverse Georgia's 2020 election results. Manhattan DA Alvin Bragg may be the only prosecutor to try Trump on criminal charges before Election Day. On Truth Social, Trump's social media platform, he called the trial, quote, this is Trump, election interference. Trump spoke Saturday at a campaign rally in the battleground state of Pennsylvania.
They're all Biden trials. You know that, right? And I'm proud to do it for you. Have a good time watching. Have a good time watching. On Monday in New York City, I will be forced to sit fully gagged. I'm not allowed to talk. Can you believe it? They want to take away my constitutional right to talk. I have a crooked judge.
For For more, we're joined by Ron Kuby, longtime criminal defense civil rights lawyer based here in New York, closely followed the Trump cases. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us.
Thank you so much.
So he talks about being persecuted and singled out. You're a longtime defense attorney. Others are saying, no, he is getting a kind of special treatment that defendants almost never get.
Well, I don't think either of those are completely true. One part of the special treatment is his case has moved very, very quickly. It's been about a year from indictment to the beginning of trial today, whereas we have thousands of young people, mostly young people of color on Rikers Island sitting there who don't have the luxury of bail, whose cases are far older. So certainly this case is moving on an expedited basis. But what Donald Trump is accused of is the type of crime that's prosecuted in New York every single day by the Manhattan DA's office. It has nothing to do with being president or a candidate or a campaign or presidential powers. It's just a sort of garden variety, ordinary grift, falsifying business records for the purpose of committing another crime. And almost everybody who falsifies their business records does so to conceal the commission of another crime. You don't just wake up in the morning and decide to falsify business records because you have nothing better to do.
Well, you're a defense attorney, and you know choosing the right jurors is extremely important. And I wanted to ask you about the juror questions, because we know a lot of those questions right now. They're going to be asked about what podcasts and talk radio programs they listen to, where they get their news. And this is question 30. Have you ever considered yourself a supporter of or belong to any of the following? The QAnon movement, Proud Boys, Oath Keepers, Three Percenters, Boogaloo Boys, and Antifa. Talk about the significance of this.
Well, both sides want to weed out people who they think, by virtue of organizational membership, are really incapable of being fair and impartial one way or the other, either to the prosecution or to the defense. Obviously, if you're a member of the Oath Keepers, no matter what you say about your ability to be fair and impartial, it could reasonably be called into question. And as far as I know, Antifa is not a membership organization. Last time I checked, they didn't issue cards. But if you self-identify as being a member of Antifa, chances are you can't be fair to Donald Trump.
This is question 31. Do you have any strong opinions or firmly held beliefs about whether a former president may be criminally charged in state court?
And that question is designed to weed out primarily the people who take the position that Donald Trump, by virtue of being the president of the United States at one point or another, is not just absolutely immune from everything that he did as president, but he's absolutely immune from everything he did in his life, period. And if you're that far off the page, then you probably should not be sitting on this jury.
Then 32, do you have any feelings about how Mr. Trump is being treated in this case?
It's another one of those questions where if people say, I think he's being treated unfairly, I think he's being persecuted, I think, you know, he's martyring himself for the rest of us, you're not going to be allowed. That's a challenge for cause in almost every situation. On the other hand, if you say, I think he's basically being treated fairly, he's being treated like everybody else, that's the answer that the prosecution is certainly looking for.
As you know, President Trump has argued that the judge, Juan Merchan, cannot be fair because his daughter works with Democratic Party candidates, and he attacks her online, which led to Merchan expanding the partial gag order. He didn't say you can't attack me, the judge, but he did say you can't attack family members.
Right. And Trump has repeated this, and his lawyers have repeated this over and over again by virtue of Judge Merchan's daughter's employment. He should be recuse himself. But Judge Merchan is an extremely meticulous jurist. He sought judicial ethics opinions on this long ago. He was told there is no conflict of interest. His daughter doesn't live underneath his roof. And moreover, Judge Merchan sat on the Trump Organization case. So he knows the people, he knows the players, he knows the lawyer, and he knows how to run a Trump trial. Just not necessarily one with Donald Trump present, but a Trump trial nonetheless.
Can you talk about now what exactly happens, what rights the lawyers have? They've got 10 peremptory challenges per side. What exactly does that mean?
A peremptory challenge is a challenge you can use for almost any reason that you want to strike a juror. You can't do it on the basis of a protected class, race, religion, national origin. But you can use it because I don't like the fact that this juror wore a suit today to sit on jury service. That shows a little too much respect for this process that we're denigrating. I want to get rid of that individual. But there's only 10 of them. And those are used very, very quickly. On the other hand, you have unlimited challenges for cause. And most of the argument around jury selection is going to be challenges for cause. But what Judge Merchan has done, they're calling 1,000 jurors to sit in jury service, unprecedented number. So anybody who at the outset, after Merchan, Judge Merchan explains the situation, he's going to ask for a show of hands. Anybody who says they can't be fair and impartial for any reason, he's not going to question them individually. You raise your hand, you're out of here. So even if 90 out of 100 potential jurors say, I can't be fair, that's fine. Then you have 10. Bring in the next 100, and you'll have a jury.
Okay. They're all, though, from Manhattan. Now, Trump says he can't get a fair trial here in his home city. Talk about that.
Number one, he doesn't want a fair trial. No defendant wants a fair trial. Every defendant wants a jury that's predisposed to acquit them. That's just sort of baked into the whole process. He certainly can get a fair trial. In the sense that you get rid of all the jurors who have strong feelings one way or the other about his guilt or his innocence. Remember, this is not a referendum on Trump as president, which would be, I think, a harder case in Manhattan. It doesn't matter whether you liked his presidency or, like most Manhattanites, loathed it. These actions, the activities accused of engaging in, they took place before he became president. The crime was committed before he became president of the United States. So it doesn't involve great questions of presidential power and authority. It's just regular old garden variety fraud, with a porn star or a sex worker added in to add some spice to it, and, of course, Attorney Michael Cohen.
So let's talk about what exactly he's being charged with. I mean, if you were giving hush money to someone, that would not be a crime.
Totally legal.
So, of course, Trump is going simply to argue he just didn't want to hurt his family, so he wanted this person to remain quiet about their affair. But this has to do with the election. Explain that.
One of the crimes, the underlying crimes that the hush money was designed to conceal was federal election finance law. That Michael Cohen was basically making an expenditure. This was a campaign expenditure, and Trump covered it up because he didn't want the American people to know that he was paying off a porn star just prior to the election. And the timing of that payment is significant, having taken place just before the election. Michael Cohen is going to testify what it was for. There's going to be conversations that Trump had with other people that make reference to Stormy Daniels and the election. And I don't know that Trump is going to be arguing anything because Trump would have to testify to make that argument.
And, of course, he says he will.
Of course
he will. But he has said that even in the civil cases. Oh,
he always says he's going to do this or he has done that. And maybe when the time the trial is over, he will have said he testified, even though he didn't. But it's unlikely, frankly, from a criminal defense perspective, it's unlikely that he's going to get on that witness stand.
We're not going to see any of this.
No. There was a brief period of time, a couple of years in the 1990s, where we had cameras in the New York State courtrooms. Most people thought it was a fantastic success, and it helped legitimize the system. Most famously, the Amadou Diallo trial, for those who remember, was televised live. Everybody could see what happened. The powers that be decided that should not be renewed, except for pretrial performances, as it were. So we're not going to see the trial.
Can someone convicted of a felony become president?
Absolutely. There's no bar to becoming president of the United States if you're convicted of a felon. However, you cannot own a firearm. So at least if he gets elected, he won't be able to have a gun. He'll have the United States military, but not a gun.
And you have to be born in the United States.
Yes.
I want to thank you very much for being with us. Ron Kuby, longtime criminal defense and civil rights lawyer here in New York. That does it for today's show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for our digital fellowship. You can learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Taracena, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nandura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Hannah Elias. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randall, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, Dennis McCormick, Matt Ely. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
RCT, in sound, from way out.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we explore how anti-pornography laws in many states can theoretically be used to prosecute teenagers.
New York City Attorney Andrew Stengel joins us to explain how courts approach the sharing of intimate photos among adolescents.
We'll also take a look at multinational corporations' roles in social responsibility, including international acts of genocide.
Simon Billinus shares his expertise on this field as well as his work with the coalition called No Business with Genocide.
Stay with us. I'm Heidi Boghossian, New York City attorney and activist.
And I'm Maria Hall, Los Angeles civil rights lawyer.
Because teenagers spend a good deal of their time online and on social media platforms, awareness has risen about related risks, such as cyberbullying, shaming, and online predation. But then there's sexting, the sharing between teenagers of explicit images. A study in the Journal of the American Medical Association revealed that sexting is common among adolescents, with at least one in four teens receiving explicit texts and emails. What we don't hear much about are the legal consequences of such communications. In half of the states in this country, criminal laws classify the act of sexting among minors as a felony. New York, California, New Jersey, and Michigan are among those states. Their laws consider the exchange, possession, distribution, or production of explicit images of minors through sexting as felony offenses under certain circumstances. The specific criteria and the penalties vary, obviously, from state to state. Teenagers who engage in sexting rarely realize the consequences of their actions. Since teens are minors, sharing nude or explicit or suggestive photos of themselves or their friends is considered child pornography. That means that possessing or sending the photos may amount to criminal possession or distribution of child pornography. And if convicted for one of these offenses, young people theoretically may face severe penalties and lifelong consequences. Joining us today is New York City criminal defense attorney Andrew Stengel. Andrew is a former prosecutor in the Manhattan District Attorney's Office who has also worked in the executive and legislative branches of New York State government, and he's also worked at the Brennan Center for Justice. Andrew, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you for having me.
Andrew, before we get into the legal aspects of sexting and teenagers, how do you define sexting?
You know, I'm reminded of the Supreme Court decision on pornography that said, you know it when you see it. I can't define it, but you know it when you see it. Usually it's used in the context of an explicit image, nudity, or sex act that's unwanted. You know, there is such thing as consensual sexting. People who are in a romantic relationship send each other images, and that's consensual. The more usual connotation, and I think what we're talking about today, is when it's non-consensual.
And we've covered the issue of revenge porn in the past. How is sexting related to revenge porn in terms of how acts of revenge are prosecuted, for example?
Well, sexting and revenge porn are sort of cousins, although sexting can be legal, as we talked about, because it could be between two consenting adults